The most important part of my job as minister is paying attention. Now, I know when people think of ministers, they think of preaching or teaching or even beseeching for money. But if you're going to have just one talent as a minister, you should make it paying attention. Now, that's not exactly what they teach in seminary, but it is the secret to good ministers and to good ministries. What ministers are on the lookout for in paying attention is not new members or not big pledges and not people willing to commit time. What ministers are on the lookout for is love. Love will lead to all of those things. All of those things will not necessarily always lead to love. Spend time in any religious community and you will find founts of love, places where love overflows from people into everything around them. But in those same communities, you will also find barren, arid places where love has died. A minister's work and the work of ministry is to be on the lookout for both places, where love is abundant and where it is absent, and to lift them both up and help the community be about the work of becoming a conduit for love to go from one to the other. This morning I want to talk about love, and specifically I want to talk about the difference between romantic love and that rarest of all commodities, true love. And I want to talk a little bit about covenant, that roadmap of promises which help direct a marriage or any kind of committed relationship, helping it to avoid those roads which will drive it off into the desert and instead taking it to the promised land. You'll notice that in your order of service this morning, there is an insert, and that insert is a draft of the covenant that's designed to be for all of us. Since every one of us who walks through these doors every Sunday and all through the week comes in part looking for love. Now, we all come with implicit assumptions about what that love looks like and what it will be when we find it. And sometimes this community, like any community, experiences a little disillusionment of noticing that other people's assumptions about what that love looked like is a little different than our own. So the pastoral care team, in wanting to help us understand how to be more successful in creating those implicit ideas to be explicit, and they asked the choir to help us get started, and the choir came up with this unbelievably amazing draft of a covenant. But we're asking everybody in the congregation to add to it, and I'll talk a little bit more about that next week. Now, religious communities are hot spots in the quest for love. People come praying for it. They pray to keep it. They pray to get over it. They pray to understand it. And ministers are always there listening and watching and paying attention. One request we ministers get a lot around love, especially among the unchurched, is the request to perform weddings. And let me say, I do enjoy doing weddings, the celebration and all of that, the parties. But to tell you the truth, if it were only for that part of the wedding, I probably wouldn't do too many. There's just too much hype and hoopla involved, that 10-story cakes, the elaborate sequin dressings, the fancy food, the incredible floral arrangements. It's like the grandiosity of the spectacle often obscures the sentiment trying to be expressed underneath, which itself is often tender and timid. But I still love doing weddings. And the reason is because I like the interviews, the part that comes before the wedding. I am a sucker for love stories. I like all kinds of love stories. Sickeningly sweet with head in the clouds love stories. Bittersweet, dramatic, feet stuck in the tar pit love stories. And everything in between. And like any minister, I'm always hoping to become a better observer of love. One of the best love stories I've ever come across came from author and former UU minister Robert Foljam. In being asked to do a wedding, he received a carefully preserved note from the mother of the bride on the eve of Susan's marriage to Bill. The note had been intercepted 16 years prior by a third grade teacher. She passed it on to parents who saved it for posterity. It read, "Dear Billy, if you don't say you love me and walk to the bus stop with me, I will kill myself and beat you up. I love you and want to marry you soon, Susie." Now, most couples who come to me for weddings usually don't have that level of determination or clarity embedded in their decision. And usually the decision is a little harder to explain and fortunately often comes without threats of violence. Most couples I've met have a harder time explaining why they want to get married, and I have heard some great lines of reasoning. I heard one woman say that she realized she loved her fiancé because he would wash her hair and paint her toenails. And I agreed that any man who would do this is indeed a catch. One man said that he loved his bride because she could laugh like a hyena, and she demonstrated it. Having never heard a hyena laugh, I couldn't really rate the quality of the impersonation, but I will say that I was glad that she could come up with other reasons. The reality is that the majority of stories that I get to hear, although sweet and endearing, usually have less to do with love and more to do with the idea of falling in love. And in that latter category, one sentiment comes up repeatedly. It is the idea of wholeness. Couples who say, "I have found the person who completes me. I feel like they are my other half." When these answers come, I nod my head and understand. The great philosopher Plato reasoned that human beings must once have been composite creatures, both male and female, each having one head with two faces, four hands and four feet, and both male and female characteristics. Being unified and whole, they wielded tremendous power. In fact, so magnificent were these androgynous beings that they dared to attack the gods. The gods, of course, would not tolerate this kind of insurrection, but didn't know how to punish the humans. "If we kill them," they said to one another, "there will be no one to worship us and offer us sacrifices." So Zeus pondered the situation and finally came up with this solution. "Humans will continue to exist," he decreed, "but they will be cut in half. Then they will be diminished in strength so that we need not fear them." Zeus proceeded to split each being in two, asking Apollo's help to make the wounds invisible. The two halves were then sent in opposite directions to spend the rest of their lives searching frantically for their other half creature, the reunion with whom would restore their wholeness. Finding that wholeness is what many couples come into my office citing proof that their love is true love. They describe their beloved as the one and only of all the earth who is meant for them. They confess having complete knowledge and understanding of one another, finishing one another's sentences, using words like fate and destiny. I smile and nod my head some more. I can understand and appreciate and even remember some of what they're feeling. It is indeed truly lovely but it is not true love. Often what they think of as true love is all the swirling emotions associated with falling in love, and it is important to realize that there is a difference. Marriage counselor Harville Hendricks points out that there is a reason why this feeling of oneness seems familiar. He claims that it is natural to long for that feeling of connection that we had during birth. Hendricks points out that before birth, every fetus shared a sense of oneness with its mother. There was an exchange of food and oxygen and warmth. And even after birth, when the two bodies were brought together, there continued to be this sense of oneness, this symbiosis and unity while the infant nursed. But eventually, we grow. And with growth comes the ability to differentiate into our own unique self with our own identity and needs and feelings. And with our own identity comes our own ego, that part of us that is created to try and protect us. And our ego loves to point out all the ways that our parents aren't always able to meet every single one of our needs. And as our abilities to grow match the size of our needs, we begin to seek independence. And with independence, we begin to grapple with the notion of being separate, indeed, even alone. And it's at that point that each individual begins to realize what Eric Fromm called humanity's greatest need, the need to overcome his or her own separateness, the need to escape the prison of his own aloneness. This echoes Plato's description of human angst at being split in two. Falling in love is the euphoric moment when we discover the unique combination of having enough attraction and enough trust and enough opportunity to lower the powerful shield of our ego and rejoice in that feeling of connection that we're able to enjoy with somebody, this time someone of our own choosing. But falling in love has its shortcomings, the greatest of which is that it's temporary. Sooner or later, we discover our partner, like our parents, aren't able to meet every one of our needs. So that when we begin to notice our partner starting to focus more on their own needs instead of answering ours, it triggers our sense of well-being and safety, and our ego snaps back into its role of protector, and disagreements arise, and tension, and eventually, most couples who briefly felt that sense of completeness with one another now discover that they are not two people experiencing oneness, but two individuals with different histories and needs and expectations in one relationship. And it's at this point that a couple will either become disillusioned and fall out of romantic love or begin the real work of creating true love. This is what God tried to explain to Joan in the TV show. He said, "Real love is hard work. You have to decide if you want it in your story or if you'd rather just live in your dreams." Now, there are more than one definition of love. Psychologist Scott Peck offers the definition that I find most helpful. He describes love as, quote, "the will to extend oneself for the purpose of nurturing one's own or another's spiritual growth." The will to extend oneself for the purpose of nurturing one's own or another's spiritual growth. This means two things. First, because love is a will to extend oneself, it is an action, not a feeling. It therefore requires work and effort and not just assumptions or dreamy eyes or sentimental words. The other thing that Peck mentions is that in order to be love, it must nurture growth. This often precludes many associations that love is comfort. Love is not protection from adversity or change. That's your ego's job. Love is the willingness to witness someone through difficult change. Searching for comfort may, in many cases, be a way to escape the pain of growth instead of helping to encourage it. offering love, that is being a nurturer of growth, is fundamental to making relationships healthy. Being a good partner in a relationship is akin to being a good minister in a church. Paying attention for love and learning to forge paths connecting the dry, arid places to the wellsprings of love. Yet being a minister also means occasionally coming across those inconsolable in romantic despair. They sometimes come into my office insisting that they were in it for the long haul, while their no good, dirty, rotten snake of a partner turned out to not be that red-caped superhero version that they married, and instead that ordinary bad breath in the morning version. I listen and I nod my head, and they ask, why can't it be easy like it's supposed to? And it's in these moments that I remember what God said to Joan. Love is big. It is a bright light in the universe, and a bright light casts a big shadow. It's when people find themselves standing in such shadows that they can feel themselves maybe falling out of love. And if they happen to be in a marriage or any kind of relationship built on a covenant of assumed promises, they can sometimes feel themselves falling out of that covenant. And it is into those shadows that the question comes of whether there is enough light and enough love for them to jump back in. And it's a real choice, because although our quest for love is probably the strongest thing in the world, we know it's not always right to beat our heads constantly against a brick wall. A covenant is not a suicide pact. But one thing is for sure. In the wake of such disillusionment, if a couple does decide that there is enough safety around them and resiliency within them to pursue a re-entering of the covenant, they will need help getting back in. This means that all the assumptions about the covenant that holds them together need to be either abandoned or clarified. Theologian Martin Buber describes human beings as a covenant-making, covenant-breaking, covenant-remaking people. The real difference between romance and true love is the willingness to work for the acceptance and change in ourselves, in our partner, and what is necessary to honor both at the same time. The rigid relationship wielded together by ultimatums and guarantees will never lead to true love. Such strategies are often more preoccupied with safety than connection. Safety, remember, is the goal of the ego, which protects us from our fears, while connection is the goal of love, which nurtures our growth. Professor of psychiatry Emmanuel Tenney has a great way of describing this. He says, there are no guarantees in relationships. From the viewpoint of fear, none are strong enough. From the viewpoint of love, none are necessary. You can always tell when love becomes true love, because by that time it is usually completely covered in band-aids. Both partners are decorated by medals of honor awarded to them by each other. They are recognized for acts of extraordinary courage or bravery, taking fire in the tantrum of 04, or the battle of the budget in 09, sent into service years earlier with little armor other than hope and a few promises, which are also all taped together by band-aids. Paying attention to the love in my own life and in the congregations I've served and the ministries I've been a part of has revealed something interesting, and it is this. Although I love weddings, I've had far more success finding stories of true love at memorials. And not just the memorials that come at the end of one's life, but the kind we have at the end of our rope, when we have to say goodbye to the person that we had been in order for us to become the person that we need to be. Maybe it's saying goodbye to our freedom when we have children, or saying goodbye to our identity as a parent when our children leave, or saying goodbye to our physical abilities as we age. True love means needing someone by your side who can see past all of those changes, past the scared parts of you, to the worthiness underneath. True love is seeing past the faults and the idiosyncrasies and calling forth the goodness over and over until we begin to love even the faults and idiosyncrasies themselves. Consider this line from the movie Good Will Hunting, where Robin Williams, the psychologist, explains to patient Will Hunting about love. She used to fart in her sleep. One night it was so loud it woke up the dog. And then she called out from her sleep, "Was that you?" I didn't have the heart to tell her. But Will, she's been dead for 2 years. And that's the stuff that I remember. Little things like that. Those are the things that I miss the most. The little idiosyncrasies that only I knew. That's what made her my wife. Oh, and she had the goods on me too. She knew all of my little peccadillos. People call those imperfections, but they're not, Will. That's the good stuff. That's the good stuff. It really is. But I'm convinced that if anyone ever got a disclaimer of the good stuff going into covenant, the marriage business would go under. It's better, I think, that people go in with a lot of willingness and little experience. For true love is not saying, "I love you and you're beautiful," but saying, "I am here for you. I will be there for you. And you can count on me always." In the words of Robert Fulghum, love is the grand prize and the garbage heap. It is cloud nine and a spiritual root canal. Love is a little taste of always and a big bite of nothing. And love is everything in between. It may be why there's that part that says, for better or worse, richer or poorer, in sickness and in health, it is the language of a realistic warranty for the love anyone is looking for. It is the only game in town for people who really want to play. Knowing that the love we really live is all the love we really have, and the love we really have is the love that's true. In my mind, Plato and Zeus had it wrong. It was not our original wholeness that made us a threat to rival the gods. It was our ability to build love from the broken pieces of our lives that gave us power. To find the wholeness from amidst the frayed edges. From this we discover the power to offer the kind of love that can resurrect hearts and to help us all rise above our separateness to the glory of life.